He believes now that her husband is dead, and he thinks I must talk to her. I must tell her she is free. She is too proper to show any pleasure. But who would not like to know that she is no longer subject to a man like that? Through Mass, Henry keeps up a constant buzz of talk. He sorts papers and passes them up and down to his counsellors. Only at the consecration does he throw himself to his knees in a fever of reverence, as the miracle takes place and a wafer becomes God. As soon as the priest says, "Ita missa est," he whispers, "Come to me in my closet alone." First, the assembled courtiers must make their bows to Anne. Her ladies sweep back and leave her alone in a little sunlit space. He watches them, watches the gentlemen and counsellors, among whom, on this feast day, are many of the king's boyhood friends. He watches Sir Nicholas Carew in particular. Nothing is wanting in his reverence to his new queen, but he cannot help a downturn of his mouth. "Arrange your face, Nicholas Carew, your ancient family face." He hears Anne saying, "These are my enemies." He adds Carew to the list. Behind the chambers of state are the king's own rooms, which only his intimates see, where he is served by his gentlemen, and where he can be free of ambassadors and spies. This is Henry Norris's ground, and Norris gently congratulates him on his new appointment, and moves away, soft-footed. "You know Cranmer is to convene a court to make a formal dissolution of the..." Henry has said he does not want to hear any more about his marriage, so he will not even say the word. "I've asked him to convene at the Priory at Dunstable, because it is, what, 10, 12 miles to Ant Hill, where she is lodged. So she can send her lawyers, if she likes, or come to the court herself. I want you to go to see her, go secretly, just talk to her. Make sure she springs no surprises. Leave Rafe with me while you are gone." At being so easily understood, the king relaxes into good humour. "I can rely on him to say what Cromwell would say. You have a good boy there, and he is better than you are at keeping his face straight. I see you, when we sit in council, with your hand before your mouth. Sometimes, you know, I want to laugh myself." He drops into a chair, covers his face as if to shade his eyes. He sees that once again the king is about to cry. "Brandon says my sister is dying. There's no more the doctors can do for her. You know that fair hair she had once? Hair like silver. My daughter had that. When she was 7, she was the image of my sister, like a saint painted on a wall. Tell me, what am I to do with my daughter?" He waits, till he knows it is a real question. "Be good to her, sir. Conciliate her. She should not suffer. But I must make her a bastard. I need to settle England on my lawful children. A parliament will do it." "Yes," he sniffs, scrubs his tears away. "After Anne is crowned. Cromwell, one thing, and then we will have our breakfast, because I'm really very hungry. This project of a match for my cousin Richard." He thinks his way rapidly around the nobility of England. But no, he sees it's his Richard, Richard Cromwell. "Lady Carey," the king's voice softens. "Well, I have thought it over, and I think no. Or at least not at this time." He nods. He understands his reason. When Anne understands it, she will spit nails. "Sometimes it is a solace to me," Henry says, "not to have to talk and talk. You were born to understand me, perhaps." That is one view of their situations. He was 6 years or so in this world before Henry came into it, years of which he made good use. Henry takes off his embroidered cap, throws it down, runs his hands through his hair. Like Wyatt's golden mane, his hair is thinning, and it exposes the shape of his massive skull. For a moment he seems like a carved statue, like a simpler form of himself, or one of his own ancestors, one of the race of giants that roamed Britain, and left no trace of themselves except in the dreams of their petty descendants. He goes back to Austin Friars as soon as he can get away. Surely he can have one day off. The crowds outside his gate have dispersed, as Thurston has fed them an Easter dinner. He goes out to the kitchen first, to give his man a slap on the head and a gold piece.
100 open moors, I swear, Thurston says. And by supper time they'll be round again.
It is a shame there should be beggars.
Beggars, my arse. What comes out of this kitchen is so good, there are aldermen out there with their hoods up so we don't know them. And I have a houseful here. Whether you are with us or not, I have Frenchmen, Germans, I have Florentiners. They all claim to know you, and they all want their dinner to their own liking. I have their servants down here, pinch of that, soups on the other. We must feed fewer or build another kitchen.
I'll get it in hand.
Master Rafe says for the tower, you bought out the whole of a quarry in Normandy. He says the Frenchmen are all undermined and dropping into holes in the ground.
Such beautiful stone, the colour of butter. 400 men on the payroll, and anyone standing about instantly redeployed to the building work at Austin Friars. Thurston, don't let anybody put pinches or soupçons in our dinner. He thinks that's how Bishop Fisher nearly died, unless it was an unboiled stockpot after all. You could never fault Thurston's stockpot. He goes and views it, bubbling away. Where is Richard, do you know?
Chopping onions on the back step. Oh, you mean Master Richard, upstairs, eating. Where's anybody?
He goes up. The Easter eggs he sees bear his own unmistakable features. Joe has painted his hat and his hair in one, so he seems to be wearing a cap with ear flaps. She's given him at least 2 chins.
Well, sir, Gregory says, it is true you are getting stout. When Stephen Vaughan was here, he could not believe you.
My master, the Cardinal, waxed like the moon, he says.
It is a mystery, because he hardly sat down to dine, but he would be leaping up to deal with some exigency. And even when he was at the table, he could hardly eat for talking. I feel sorry for myself. I have not broken bread since last night.
He breaks it, and says, Hans wants to paint me. I hope he can run fast, Richard says.
Richard,
have your dinner.
My breakfast. No, never mind it. Come.
The happy bridegroom, Gregory says, taunting.
You, his father threatens him, are going north with Roland Lee. If you think I'm a hard man, wait till you meet Roland. In his office, he says, How is your practice in the lists?
Good.
Cromwell's will knock down all comers.
He's afraid for his son. That he will fall, be maimed, be killed.
Afraid for Richard, too. These boys are the hope of his house.
Richard says, So am I, the happy bridegroom?
The king says no. It's not because of my family, or your family. He calls you his cousin. He is, at this moment, his disposition to us, I would say, it is excellent. But he needs Mary for himself. The child is due in late summer, and he's afraid to touch Anne, and he does not wish to resume his celibate life.
Richard looks up. He said this?
He left me to understand it, and as I understand it, I convey it to you, and we are both amazed. But we get over it.
I suppose if the sisters were more alike, one could begin to understand it.
I suppose, he says, one could.
And he is the head of our church. No wonder foreigners laugh.
If he were a model of conduct in his private life, one would be surprised. But for me, you see, I can only concern myself with his kingship. If he were oppressive, if he were to override Parliament, if he were to pay no heed to the Commons and govern only for himself. But he does not. So I cannot concern myself with how he behaves to his women.
But if he were not king...
Oh, I agree. You'd have him locked up. But again, Richard, leave aside Mary, and he has behaved well enough. He hasn't filled a nursery with his bastards, as the Scottish kings do. There have been women. But who can name them? Only Richmond's mother and the Boleyns. He has been discreet. I dare say Catherine knew their names. Who can say he will be a faithful husband? Will you? I may not get the chance. On the contrary. I have a wife for you. Thomas Murfin's girl. A Lord Mayor's daughter is not a bad prospect. And your fortune will more than match hers. I will make sure of that. And Frances likes you. I know because I have asked her. You have asked my wife to marry me? Since I was dining there yesterday. No point in delay, was there? Not really. Richard laughs. He stretches back in his chair. His body, his capable, admirable body, which has impressed the king so much, is rinsed with relief. Francis. Good. I like Francis. Mercy approves. He cannot think how she would have taken to Lady Carey. He had not broached the topic with the women. She says, "Don't leave it too long to make a match for Gregory. He is very young, I know. But some men never grow up until they have a son of their own." He hasn't thought about it, but it might be true. In that case, there's hope for the Kingdom of England. 2 days later, he is back at the Tower. The time goes quickly between Easter and Whit, when Anne will be crowned. He inspects her new apartments and orders in braziers to help dry out the plaster. He wants to get on with the frescoes. He wishes Hans would come down, but he is painting de Danteville, and says he needs to push on with it, as the ambassador is petitioning Francis for his recall, a whining letter on every boat. For the new queen, we are not going to have those hunting scenes you see painted everywhere, or grim virgin saints with the instruments of their torture, but goddesses, doves, white falcons, canopies of green leaves. In the distance, cities seated on the hills. In the foreground, temples, groves, fallen columns, and hot blue skies, delineated as within a frame by borders of Vitruvian colours, quicksilver and cinnabar, burnt ochre, malachite, indigo and purple. He unrolls the sketches the craftsmen have made. Minerva's owl spreads her wings across a panel. A barefoot Diana fits an arrow to her bow. A white doe watches her from the trees. He scribbles a direction to the overseer. Arrow to be picked out in gold. All goddesses have dark eyes. Like a wingtip from the dark, dread brushes him. What if Anne dies? Henry will want another woman. He will bring her to these rooms. Her eyes may be blue. We will have to scour away the faces and paint them again, against the same cities, the same violet hills. Outside, he stops to watch a fight. A stonemason and the bricklayer's gaffer are swiping at each other with batons. He stands in the ring with the trowel men. "What's it about?"
"Nothing. Stone men have to fight brick men.
Like Lancaster and York.
Like that."
"Have you ever heard of the field called Towton? The king tells me more than 20,000 Englishmen died." The man gawps at him.
"Who were they fighting?"
"Each other." It was Palm Sunday, the year 1461. The armies of two kings met in the driving snow. King Edward, the king's grandfather, was the winner, if you can say there was a winner at all. Corpses made a bobbing bridge across the river. Uncounted numbers crawled away, rolled and tumbled in their own blood. Some blinded, some disfigured, some maimed for life. The child in Anne's womb is the guarantee of no more civil war. He is the beginning, the start of something, the promise of another country. He walks into the fight. He bellows at them to stop. He gives them both a push, and they bowl over backwards. Two crumbly Englishmen, snappable bones, chalky teeth. Victors of Agincourt. He's glad Chapuis isn't there to see. The trees are in full leaf when he rides into Bedfordshire, with a small train on unofficial business. Christoph rides beside him and pesters him. "You have said you will tell me who is Cicero, and who is Reginald Pole."
"Cicero was a Roman."
"A general?"
"No, he left that to others, as I, for example, might leave it to Norfolk."
"Oh, Norfolk.
Christophe subjects the Duke to his peculiar pronunciation.
He is one who pisses on your shadow.
Dear God, Christophe. I've heard of spitting on someone's shadow.
Yes, but we speak of Nofiac and Cicero.
We lawyers try to memorize all his speeches. If any man were walking around today with all of Cicero's wisdom in his head, he would be what? Cicero would be on the king's side, he says. Christoph is not much impressed.
Paul, he is a general.
A priest. That is not quite true. He has offices in the church, but he has not been ordained.
Why not?
No doubt so he can marry. It is his blood that makes him dangerous. He is a Plantagenet. His brothers are here in this kingdom under our eye. But Reginald is abroad, and we are afraid he is plotting with the Emperor.
Send one to kill him. I will go.
No, Christophe. I need you to stop the rain spoiling my hats.
As you wish.
Christophe shrugs.
But I will kill a Pole when you require it. Will be my pleasure.
The manor at Ampt Hill, once fortified, has airy towers and a splendid gatehouse. It stands on a hill with views over wooded countryside. It is a pleasant seat, the kind of house you'd visit after an illness to get your strength back. It was built with money gained in the French Wars, in the days when the English used to win them. To accord with Catherine's new status as Dowager Princess of Wales, Henry has trimmed her household, but still she is surrounded by chaplains and confessors, by household officers, each with their own train of menials, by butlers and carvers, physicians, cooks, scullions, maltsters, harpers, lutenists, poultry keepers, gardeners, laundresses, apothecaries, and an entourage of wardrobe ladies, bedchamber ladies, and their maids. And when he is ushered in, she nods to her attendants to withdraw. No one had told her to expect him, but she must have spies on the road. Hence her nonchalant parade of occupation, a prayer book in her lap, and some sewing. He kneels to her, nods towards these encumbrances. Surely, madam, one or the other.
Saw English today. Get up, Cromwell. We will not waste our time, as at our last interview, selecting which language to use, because nowadays you are such a busy man.
Formalities over, she says.
First thing, I shall not attend your court at Dunstable. That is what you have come to find out, is it not? I do not recognize this court. My case is at Rome, awaiting the attention of the Holy Father.
Slow, isn't he? He gives her a puzzled smile.
I will wait.
But the king wishes to settle his affairs.
He has a man who will do it. I do not call him an archbishop.
Clement issued the bulls.
Clement was misled. Dr. Cranmer is a heretic.
Perhaps you think the king is a heretic?
No. Only a schismatic.
If a general council of the church were called, his majesty would submit to its judgment.
It will be too late, if he is excommunicate and put outside the church.
We all hope, I'm sure you do, madam, that day will never come.
Nulla salus extra ecclesiam. Outside the church there is no salvation. Even kings come to judgment. Henry knows it and is afraid.
Madam, give way to him. For the present. Tomorrow, who knows? Do not cut off every chance of rapprochement.
I hear Thomas Boleyn's daughter is having a child.
Indeed, but Catherine, above anyone, should know that guarantees nothing. She takes his meaning, thinks about it, nods.
I see circumstances in which he might turn back to me. I have had much opportunity to study that lady's character, and she is neither patient nor kind.
It doesn't matter. She only has to be lucky. In the event they have no children, you should think of your daughter, Lady Mary. Conciliate him, madam. He may confirm her as his heir, and if you will give way, he will offer you every honour and a great estate.
A great estate?
Catherine stands up. Her sewing slides from her skirts. The prayer book hits the floor with a fat, leathery thump, and a silver thimble goes skittering across the boards and rolls into a corner.
"Before you make me any more preposterous offers, Master Cromwell, let me offer you a chapter from my history. After my Lord Arthur died, I passed 5 years in poverty. I could not pay my servants. We bought in the cheapest food we could find, coarse food, stale food, yesterday's fish. Any small merchant kept a better table than the daughter of Spain. The late King Henry would not let me go back to my father because he said he was owed money. He haggled over me like one of the doorstep women who sold us bad eggs. I put my faith in God. I did not despair, but I tasted the depth of humiliation."
"So why would you want to taste it again?" Face to face, they glare at each other. "Assuming," he says, "humiliation is all the king intends."
"Say it plainly."
"If you are found out in treason, the law will take its course with you, as if you were any other subject. Your nephew is threatening to invade us in your name."
"That will not happen, not in my name."
"That is what I say, madam." He softens his tone. "I say the emperor is busy with the Turks. He's not so fond of his aunt, saving your presence, that he will raise another army. But others say, oh, be quiet, Cromwell, what do you know? They say we must fortify our harbours, we must raise troops, we must put the country in a state of alert. Chapuis, as you know, continually agitates with Charles to blockade our ports and impound our goods and our merchant ships abroad. He urges war in every dispatch."
"I have no knowledge of what Chapuis puts in his dispatches."
"It is a lie so staggering that he has to admire it. Having delivered it, Catherine seems weakened. She sinks down again into her chair, and before he can do it for her, she wearily bends from the waist to pick up her sewing. Her fingers are swollen, and bending seems to leave her breathless. She sits for a moment, recovering herself, and when she speaks again, she is calm, deliberate.
"Master Cromwell, I know I have failed you. That is to say, I have failed your country, which by now is my country too. The king was a good husband to me, but I could not do that which is most necessary for a wife to do. Nevertheless, I am a wife. You see, do you, that it is impossible for me to believe that for 20 years I was a harlot? Now the truth is, I have brought England little good, but I would be loath to bring her any harm."
"But you do, madam. You may not will it, but the harm is done."
"England is not served by a lie."
"That is what Dr. Cranmer thinks. So he will annul your marriage, whether you come to the court or not."
"Dr. Cranmer will be excommunicated too. Does it not cause him a qualm? Is he so lost to everything?"
"This archbishop is the best guardian of the church, madam, that we have seen in many centuries. He thinks of what Baynham said before they burned him. In England, there have been 800 years of mystification, just 6 years of truth and light, 6 years since the gospel in English began to come into the kingdom. Cranmer is no heretic. He believes as the king believes. He will reform what needs reformation, that is all."
"I know where this will end. You will take the church's lands and give them to the king."
She laughs.
"Oh, you are silent. You will. You mean to do it."
She sounds almost light-hearted, as people do sometimes when they're told they're dying.
"Master Cromwell, you may assure the king I will not bring an army against him. Tell him I pray for him daily. Some people, those who do not know him as I do, they say, oh, he will work his will. He will have his desire at any price. But I know that he needs to be on the side of the light. He is not a man like you, who just packs up his sins in his saddlebags and carries them from country to country, and when they grow too heavy, whistles up a mule or two and soon commands a train of them and a troop of muleteers. Henry may err, but he needs to be forgiven. I therefore believe, and will continue to believe, that he will turn out of this path of error in order to be at peace with himself. And peace is what we all wish for, I am sure.
What a placid end you make, madam. Peace is what we all wish for. Like an abbess. You are quite sure, by the way, that you would not think of becoming an abbess. A smile. Quite a broad smile.
I shall be sorry if I don't see you again. You are so much quicker in conversation than the Duke's.
The Duke's will be back.
I am braced. Is there news of my Lady Suffolk?
The King says she is dying. Brandon has no heart for anything.
I can well believe it, she murmurs. Her income as Dowager, Queen of France, dies with her, and that is the greater part of his revenue. Still, no doubt, you will arrange him a loan at some iniquitous rate of interest.
She looks up.
My daughter will be curious to know I have seen you. She believes you were kind to her.
He only remembers giving her a stool to sit on. Her life must be bleak if she remembers that.
Properly, she should have remained standing, awaiting a sign from me.
Her own pain-racked little daughter. She may smile, but she doesn't yield an inch. Julius Caesar would have had more compunction. Hannibal.
Tell me, she says, testing the ground, the King would read a letter from me.
Henry has taken to tearing her letters up unread, or burning them. He says they disgust him with their expressions of love. He does not have it in him to tell her this.
Then rest for an hour, she says, while I write it. Unless you will stay a night with us, I should be glad of company at supper.
Thank you, but I must start back. The council meets tomorrow. Besides, if I stayed, where would I put my mules? Not to mention my team of drivers.
Oh, the stables are half empty. The King makes sure I am kept short of mounts. He thinks that I will give my household the slip and ride to the coast and escape on a ship to Flanders.
And will you?
He has retrieved her thimble. He hands it back. She bounces it in her hand, as if it were a die, as she were ready to cast it.
No, I shall stay here, or go where I am sent, as the King wills, as a wife should.
Until the excommunication, he thinks. That will free you from all bonds as wife, as subject. This is yours, too.
He opens his palm. In it a needle, tip towards her. The word is about town that Thomas More has fallen into poverty. He laughs about it with Master Secretary Gardiner.
Alice was a rich widow when he married her, Gardiner says. And he has land of his own. How can he be poor? And the daughters? He's married them well.
And he still has his pension from the King. He is sifting through paperwork for Stephen, who is preparing to appear as leading counsel for Henry at Dunstable. He has filed away all the depositions from the Blackfriars hearings, which seem to have happened in another era.
Angels defend us, Gardiner says. Is there anything you don't file?
If we keep on to the bottom of this chest, I'll find your father's love letters to your mother. He blows dust off the last batch. There you are. The papers hit the table. Stephen, what can we do for John Frith? He was your pupil at Cambridge. Don't abandon him.
But Gardiner shakes his head and busies himself with the documents, leafing through them, humming under his breath, exclaiming,
Well, who'd have known? And here's a nice point.
He gets a boat down to Chelsea. The ex-chancellor is at ease in his parlour, daughter Margaret translating from the Greek in a drone barely audible. As he approaches, he hears him pick her up on some error.
Leave us, daughter,
More says, when he sees him.
I won't have you in this devil's company.
But Margaret looks up and smiles, and More rises from his chair, a little stiff as if his back is bad, and offers a hand. It is Reginald Pole, lying in Italy, who says he is a devil. Point is, he means it. It's not an image with him, as in a fable, but something he takes to be true, as he takes the gospel to be true.
Well, he says. "We hear you can't come to the coronation because you can't afford a new coat.